Welcome to the Domestic Abuse Breakthrough Show, where we tackle violence against women and girls through education, empowerment, and hope. Join Kate, a survivor and advocate, as she shares insights, strategies, and stories that inspire healing and action. Together, we'll break the cycle and pave the way for a future of safety and strength. This show contains a trigger warning. And now, here's your host, Kate Beasley.
So welcome back to another episode of the Domestic Abuse Breakthrough Show. Today, I have the absolute honour of having Yasmin Javid on with me. Yasmin is a mum who has sadly lost her daughter. Fawzia's case was aired on Channel 4 documentary, The Push. And if any of you haven't seen it, I would highly encourage you to watch it. This is where they aired on the documentary the hearing where they charged her husband with murder. Welcome to the show, Yasmin, and thank you for joining me, because obviously there's a lot to be learned from what Fawzia experienced. Do you want to tell people about yourself and beautiful Fawzia?
Yeah. I'm very privileged and honored. I'm very privileged and honored to say that I'm the mother of Fawzia Javid. And Fawzia was our only child, the perfect daughter, niece, granddaughter, cousin, and friend. She was not only my daughter, but she was my best friend and confidant. Many people who saw us together thought we were friends, and we shared a very close bond together and did everything together. She was the centre of our world, the glue that kept the family together. She was our everything, and we lived and breathed for Fawzia. A beautiful soul, not just from the outside, but from the inside too. She was kind-hearted, and she wore her heart on her sleeve. She was selfless, a great philanthropist, successful, and she was an academic achiever, accomplished, a great sense of humour, loving, caring, and described by many, many people as a truly amazing and wonderful person. And, you know, I could spend all day telling you about all the fantastic charity work that Fawzia did and all the people that Fawzia helped. You know, Fawzia helped people that I didn't even know about until after the tragedy. People have come forward and they've told me. She was very humble and she would never, ever openly discuss what she had done for others. It was between Fawzia and that person. And she touched the hearts of everyone that she met. And, you know, her friends have said to me, they're never going to find a friend like Fawzia. She was popular in every friendship group that she was in. And, you know, something, she made a mark on people wherever she went. Even those people that she met just the once and very briefly. And she really would literally light up the room with her outgoing, bubbly personality and warmth character. And she was well-liked, popular, and everybody wanted to be a friend and to be in her company.
What was she like as a child?
Oh, very, very outgoing, very bubbly. She would speak to anybody. She wasn't a shy person at all. Very, very caring. You know, even at nursery, she would always share her toys with the other children. And I even remember one mother once said, and bear in mind, Fawzia was only 3 at the time. She turned around to this mother and said, something along the lines of, your son, he must be feeling very, very cold. Let me do his buttons up on his coat.
Oh.
I can honestly say that I've never ever known anyone to have any cause to say Fosie has been unpleasant to them. She
Yeah.
didn't have a bad bone in her body.
Yeah. I know this. A lot of people will be thinking that to be controlled is quite common in Muslim Islamic marriages. But Fawzia wasn't your traditional Muslim wife, was she, at all? She was very, very outgoing. She was career driven. And in fact, you told me, didn't you, that she you had a conversation with his family and said, look, she can't cook, she can't.
Well, firstly, let me just say to you, I think it's a very stereotypical type of view
It is.
that this happens in Muslim marriages. Can I assure you, there's a lot of marriages that I know of, it doesn't happen in. And from the feedback that I've got from other women and some men, it's happening across the board, irrespective of what religion and community a person comes from. There's no stereotypical type of woman this is happening to. It's across the board.
Absolutely, it is.
And the conversations that I did have with the parents were open and honest conversations. I told them, I said, Fawzi is my only child, as you know. We've brought her up with a lot of love and care and protection. And she's not the type of woman that will be chained up to the kitchen. Not that I thought that they would be like that, but I just wanted to be very, very open. I said, Fawzi spent most of her adult life studying to become a lawyer. And obviously, she was away at university. And I've done all the cooking and the housework. Yeah, she can do the basics, get by, but she's not your cordon bleu in the kitchen. And they were absolutely acceptable of this. And I even remember the mother saying, well, there's only three of us in the house at the moment, meaning herself, her son, and her husband. And I always cook plenty of food, and there's always lots of food in the fridge. And she says, besides, I wouldn't expect Fawzi to come home from work doing a full-time job and then start cooking and cleaning. And everybody knows that a lawyer's job isn't just 9 to 5. And she also said, look, I'll teach her. And even the husband said, she knows how to use a microwave, doesn't she? The fridge is always full of food. And I remember having several conversations like this with them. And they were very, very, as they came across, very,
You
very
know, on the right
happy,
side.
very, very, very acceptable. And I remember murderer saying, my parents are going round telling everybody, oh, our son's going to marry a lawyer. She's an only child. She's privately educated. And the fact that she was a philanthropist, very generous, very kind. And there was nothing hidden from our part. When I say our part, I mean mine, my husband's, and Fawzia's. We were very, very clear on the type of person that Fawzia was. And they knew, and they seemed to be very accepting of this.
Because they but obviously that was a front that they were putting on.
Absolutely.
Underneath it all, they had another hidden agenda.
Absolutely.
And as he said, you're not going to be like those British, a British woman.
Yeah, absolutely.
And this is what is really important to put across to the listeners is that domestic abuse happens in every single culture,
Absolutely.
nationality. It happens, it doesn't matter what color, race, or anything you are. Domestic abuse is a pandemic in itself.
It's a pandemic and nobody's immune from it.
Yes, there are additional things when we are evaluating risk, when you are looking at honour-based crimes. But people that engage in those honour-based offences, honour-based forms of abuse, they're interpreting the religion to
Absolutely.
suit themselves, because that's not what it actually says, is it? Is
No.
no.
I mean, the teachings of the Quran in Islam, the holy book in Islam, teaches us the best of men are those that are good to their wives. And, women hold a very, very high honor in Islam. And obviously, murder is forbidden. You kill one person, irrespective of who they are. It's like you've killed the whole of mankind, and that is what the teachings of the Quran teach you. So, and divorce is acceptable, but
And they and
murder
you know,
is
these
forbidden.
people, these people that do commit, honor-based crimes, and
Yes.
engage in honor-based homicide, they hide behind a topic that is not very well known in this society. And the likes of the professionals are so afraid to overstep that mark and enter into the realms of racism and not honoring their religion, and they're so afraid of it that they miss a lot of, they ignore a lot of red flags because of that, unfortunately.
I mean, there is no honor in what this
100%. No, there's
monster did to Fawzia. No honor
no.
whatsoever. I mean, it's
No.
like I've just said, divorce is acceptable in Islam, murder is forbidden, and women hold a very, very high status in Islam. The teachers of the Quran tell us that. And the best of men are those that are good to their wives. It's very, very clear. But like you said,
They twist the narrative to suit
absolutely.
themselves.
Yeah,
That's what they do.
exactly. Exactly.
And that goes the same in any relationship.
Of course,
We
absolutely.
are supposed to, when we are in a relationship, it's not a case of, what one is more dominant than the other. It should be a case of give and take in every relationship. It should be a case of, you look after each other, you take care of each other,
Of course it
you are
is.
there for each other, in the good times and the bad times. And in terms of, looking after, men have a protective role. If we go back to, I know it's quite old fashioned, and I am quite old fashioned. Women should feel safe with men.
Of course they should,
100%. Men
absolutely,
should make
especially the
sure.
man that has taken vows to
Absolutely.
protect you and look after you. And this is something that I was promised, not just by him, but by his parents. I mean, every child is special, but this was our only child who we loved and cherished.
And
And
they
they
actually took
promised.
ownership of her, didn't they? They were She became their property.
Well, that's how they viewed it. I mean, she didn't become their
Oh
property,
no, in
but
their eyes,
that's
yeah.
how, in their eyes, that's how they viewed her.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And she was it should nobody should ever view, and that is a common thing with abusers. The woman becomes their property. And
Absolutely.
again, that's not a culture. That's something I want to make very clear to the listeners, is that is not a cultural thing.
No, no.
That is a trait of an abuser. You
Of
become
course.
a coercive controller when they you get up, doesn't matter whether you're married to them or whether you are just dating them. You become their property. That's it. And they are in control of you. And if you step out of line, they feel like they are entitled
Of course.
punished you for that.
Absolutely. And everything is your fault. It's never their fault.
No.
Everything is your fault. The gaslighting, the victim blaming, the narcissism.
Well, we're going to just break for a short interval and we are going to carry on after the break and delve into the when you first spotted the red flags and when Fosia first spotted the red flags that she communicated with you. So we'll see you after the interval.
The station that makes you feel good.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
Imagine. Every day, clients walk into your office with their concerns about intimacy, identity, desire, and trauma. Questions that require more than basic training. Emotional and sexual dynamics are evolving, and today's professionals must evolve with them. We hear from parents unable to start conversations with their children around identity. Too often, adolescents have learned their sexual ideas from the internet. Couples have difficulty communicating about sex with each other. At the International Institute of Clinical Sexology, you can gain the specialized skills and knowledge to address those issues with confidence. Whether you are a therapist, coach, educator, or other healthcare professional, our advanced certifications and PhD program empower you to become a highly skilled, sought-after sex therapist. Expand your expertise. Elevate your earning potential. Start your journey today with the International Institute of Clinical Sexology. Imagine making a difference in our world. Learn more at clinicalsexologyphd.org.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
So, welcome back. Now, the escalation, I mean, obviously I talk a lot about when we're risk assessing, and we've just seen in our in the interval, we've just been chatting about the risk assessing and the importance of it. And obviously that this is something that I'm actually trained to approved to train professionals in to do. Now, risk assessing, we look at escalation points, and we look at we're looking for that shift in behavior. When was that first shift in behavior that you first noticed, Jasmine?
Right. Now, bearing in mind the type of person that Fosia was, she was the type of person who would never ever want to worry her parents. She would rather suffer in silence and try and deal with it herself than worry her parents. But I noticed, say about 4 months before the murder, Fosia was visiting my house and she wasn't her normal self.
And
And
how long after the marriage was that?
this was only, say, about a few months after the marriage. And I noticed she wasn't her normal self. I mean, Fosia was always bubbly and chatty, sense of humor, and she was still like that, but there was something not right. And you know, a lot of it is a blur, but I do remember Fosie started telling me snippets of how abusive he was with his language and what he'd done. He started blocking some male members of the family from Fosie's phone, not allowing her to speak to her young cousins and my cousin. And he didn't like her contacting her friends. And then she even mentioned the fact that he'd stolen £12,000 from her bank account while she was asleep.
And how long into it was?
Well, she hadn't told me about it straight away, but I think it was about 2 months after the marriage that he stole the money.
Okay.
And she also told me the fact that she told his parents about his behaviour, and a lot of the times he was behaving abusive to Fosie in front of them. And she told them about the money, and immediately they said to her, "Oh, don't tell your parents." And almost even saying to her that he's entitled to that money because you're married to him. Yeah. And I thought, look, we need to report this to the police. And on that visit to my house, I did contact the police. Fosie was staying for a couple of days, and I did contact the police, and that was the first police visit when they came and took a statement from Fosie. And you see that police visit, a snippet of it, on the documentary with the two women police officers.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, we'll talk about the the failings of the police further on. Yeah. That was one thing that I said to you straight away after, I mean, before we even touched on all the other failings. They had every opportunity just on that small, or what they the small bit that they've covered on the documentary to intervene.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah.
So. And I felt that Fosie was holding back stuff, but that was because she didn't want to worry me. Because she'd always start off by saying, "Look, I don't want you to worry."
Yeah.
And the fact is, obviously, she told them enough for them to actually say to her, "Look, you're medium risk." And then, obviously, unknown to me and Fosie, after the murder, I discovered that they had reassessed Fosie's situation and regraded it at high risk.
Yeah, yeah.
But we didn't know that.
So when Fosie said that they were being abusive with their language, was there name calling and what sort of?
Yeah, calling her horrible names, threatening me and her father, and the parents. They would take his side, and the father and the mother, both of them, very, very complicit.
Yeah. And
it was like water of a duck's back to them. But obviously, this was abuse, coercive control.
Yeah,
But for them, it was water of a duck's back. It was basically, he's your husband. You know, he's entitled. And
that's it.
Like that.
Yeah, that's it. And it's that entitlement.
Or
they have entitled to do what they want.
Yeah.
Mm. And of course, you know, we always have to look at the perpetrator's upbringing,
yeah,
childhood, as to why they are the way they are. And you know, it can be for a couple of reasons. It can be because they've witnessed it in the home. And it also can be because both parents are toxic and they are normalizing. And
absolutely, did normalize it all. They normalized everything.
Yeah, and minimizing how they behave with other people, because I do not believe for one minute that he hasn't been abusive towards other people. Parents know about it.
Well, I'll be honest with you. I witnessed it And even Fawzia told me that all three of them, the mother, father and the son, were abusive towards one another.
Right.
And yeah. It was like normalized.
Yeah.
It was part of their when I say culture, I don't mean culture as in the Asian culture, but their own invented culture.
Yeah. Just a very toxic relationship.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Family. Well, and it speaks volumes when, you know, some of their other siblings have departed. You know, it's that does speak volumes. So yeah. When did Fawzia find out she was pregnant? How long into the marriage was that? Because of course that's another escalation that we look for.
It was a few weeks before the murder.
Right. That's when she found out.
Yeah. A few weeks before the murder.
And had she told him she was pregnant?
Yeah. Right. But yeah, because if you see the documentary, he takes leadership and comes to the house.
Of course, yeah.
The house was his father.
Yeah. And what happened at the hospital? Because obviously there was abuse at the hospital.
There was.
Why was this at the hospital?
Yeah, this was a week before the murder. Hmm. Fawzia got taken in with a water infection.
Right.
And he was very abusive towards her. And obviously this was witnessed by a lady in the next bed. And she actually went and told a midwife about the abuse and what he'd been saying. And although Fawzia did tell me, she said that he'd been shouting. And when I asked Fawzia, what did he say? She said, I can't remember. And now, obviously, it was because she didn't want to worry me.
Of course, yeah.
And what happened, all this information was communicated to the police officer on the second visit, which was 6 days before the murder.
And what was said at the hospital? what did the witness disclose? I know there was some of it she
couldn't. Well, I didn't know until I was in court because Fawzia had said she couldn't remember, and obviously she was saying that to protect me, but he was saying things like it'd be better off if you were dead. You're a disease in everybody's life.
Because I know there was a recording, wasn't there, of a telephone conversation where he did say that when you're dead, life will be better.
Yeah, that happened just before the first police visit. Four months ago.
Oh, just before the first one.
Right. But them recordings were handed over to the police on the first police visit.
And that just highlights even more the huge failings.
Yeah. I was sat there when the police were interviewing Fawzia, and I'll be honest, she was playing the recordings, but as a mother, I was so distressed. I was more listening to the tone of his voice rather than what he was saying.
Yeah.
And I just wanted Fawzia to come back home. But here you've got two police officers that are trained. They obviously were listening to the contents properly. And obviously nothing was done.
Before we break for another short interval and we move on with this topic of the police failings, because I saw a picture on the documentary where Fawzia, because obviously all the other pictures, she took a lot of pride in her appearance. She was always very well put together. But there was one picture where she was really looking quite, there was no makeup on. She looked withdrawn.
Yeah.
Very withdrawn. Do you recall that picture?
Yeah, I do.
But What was do you think that was he controlling what she was wearing and how she presented
Absolutely, he
herself?
was. Yeah, absolutely, he was. Absolutely.
Yeah, because I know you said to me that he didn't like the fact that she was attractive and other
That's
men
right, yeah. He
attractive.
he'd make comments, he'd say things like, when we go out, men look at Fawzia because she's really beautiful, and it was a problem for him.
Yeah.
And so I says, well, that's not Fawzia's fault, but the way he was talking was, it's Fawzia's fault,
Yeah.
you
And
know?
that should be, if anything, something to be proud about,
Of
that you
course,
have a beautiful
absolutely.
wife on your arm and
But do you know what it was? Everything that was a positive before the marriage was now a negative. The fact that you're a lawyer, that was a negative.
of course.
Oh, he'd say things like, oh, you think you're above everybody else because you're a lawyer. You couldn't have met a more humble person. He'd say things like, oh, you went to a private school. He'd pull fun at that. The fact that she was very generous and giving as something that he liked about her. Well, so he made out beforehand. He'd say, oh, people take advantage of your generosity. You know, everything was now a negative that was once upon a time a positive.
And that unfortunately is a typical MO, modus
Yeah,
operandi from a
absolutely.
perpetrator.
But
They
it wasn't
everything
just
they
him.
originally love about you, they
Yeah.
becomes everything they resent and
Yeah.
despise about you.
I mean, everything that was a positive, but it wasn't just him. It was the parents as well. You know, they were very, very complicit in all this and agreed with everything that he said. In fact, I remember him saying to Fawzia the night that Fawzia made them recordings, obviously, he didn't know about this until after the murder. But I remember him saying to Fawzia, he said, my parents were laughing when they were listening to him, the way he was being abusive to Fawzia on the phone. And I believe that because the interactions I had with the parents, I mean, I can tell you many, many toxic interactions I had with the parents regarding his behavior and theirs. And I remember the father saying to me on one occasion, oh, if somebody was listening into this conversation now, meaning what I was saying to them about their behavior, people would laugh. And if you look at the documentary, and how he's behaving, and then obviously what the son's saying to Fawzia, my parents were laughing. I don't need to say any more.
And again, unfortunately, that is something that's very, very common. It's
Yeah,
very, very common for
absolutely. You know,
family members that enable the
that's it.
perpetrator.
Being
They
very, very
find it funny.
flippant about everything, even being flippant about the murder.
Yeah. I mean, it reminds me very much of when my ex-husband locked me and our then 18-month-old out of the marital home, the family home. He was our 18-month-old was she was she needed feeding, she needed a nappy changing, and she was banging on the door saying in. And
Oh.
he was stood at the window, and eventually I took her and I changed her nappy on the back seat of the car outside the house, and he was stood at the window with the window open, laughing on the phone to his brother.
Yeah,
As he
exactly that.
locked me and our daughter out, and that's how twisted they are.
Absolutely, absolutely. And they'll twist everything to fit in
Yeah,
with their narrative.
absolutely.
Everything, everything. You know, it's no exaggeration to say Fawzia couldn't breathe without them three. When I say them three, the son and the parents basically abusing her.
Right, we're going to break for another interval and we're going to move on to the endless amount of failings from the police, which could have avoided this horrendous fatality.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving. It's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
Sarah wasn't bad at her job, she was stuck in hidden grief. After her dog died, she took a sales role just to stay busy, but every pitch felt empty. A Cogna Movement session uncovered that she was seeking the warmth of her dog rather than serving her clients. Using our patented movement and sensory patterns, she cleared the grief and rocketed to the top. What hidden emotion is holding you back? Try our Essentials program at the special UK Health Radio rate. Visit cognamovement.com/radio or click on the Cogna Movement banner on the UK Health Radio homepage. Results vary.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
So welcome back after the break. As we said before the interval, Fosia was failed beyond belief by the police. There was more than one occasion where they had more than one opportunity where they could have intervened, and even with what was covered on the documentary, that alone screams out lots and lots of red flags. They could have intervened at four months prior to this incident occurring. To risk assess her as medium risk at that point was them not doing their risk assessments properly at all. They were clearly demonstrating their ignorance on the topic and the issue at hand. There was loads of red flags, and the fact that Fosia said that she didn't want to proceed with charges, that's normal. That is to be expected. Yeah. Not many victims that are still living with, and even some that are separated from the perpetrator, when they reach out. I know it was you initially that reached out,
but she agreed to it.
Did she?
Yeah.
You see, all they want is, and I can say this from having been in Fosia's shoes, all we want is for the abuse to stop.
Yeah.
That's all we want. We want to feel heard. We want to feel acknowledged and validate our experience so that we don't feel like we're going crazy, because that's how the perpetrator makes us feel, that actually.
Yeah.
We are to blame for their behaviour. So that, you know, this is normal, and the police should be very, very aware of this. That it's highly unusual for many victims to turn around and say, "Yeah, I want to press charges," because actually all they want is to. Put some control over the situation. That's all they're seeking. They want you to manage. They're looking to you for help. They're looking for safety, and they want you to put steps in place that manages and controls things. That's what they initially want. They don't initially want revenge and to get them into trouble with the law. All they want is to secure safety and to feel safe.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah. And this is what a lot of professionals lose sight of, is they think that, oh, they just want revenge. No, it's not about revenge.
No, not at all.
Most victims don't want revenge. They just want to feel safe. That's all they want.
That's it. They want to be heard.
Yeah.
And they want to be believed. And yeah. They want to be safe.
Exactly. Exactly. You know, and you know, on that on, I mean, obviously they, you said they were there 3 hours, and that's a long time to be there and them to not take any action. Obviously we only saw a small snippet of what took place at that visit. What other things were discussed in that 3 hour window, that 3 hour visit?
Yeah, well, Fawzi disclosed stuff to the two police officers 4 months before the murder that I didn't know anything about. She was very, very reluctant because I was sat there. But she told them enough for them to know that later on they had reassessed it to high risk. But she told them, well, she handed over the voice recordings to them. And yeah. I remember at one point he actually rang up whilst they were there. And he was being abusive.
And they whilst they were there, right.
Yeah, so they noted. So obviously they noted that he was being abusive. But she told them about the fact that he'd stolen money. She told them about the fact that he'd put a pillow over her head and started hitting her. She told them about the fact that he'd knocked her out in a graveyard. She told them all that.
He knocked her out in a graveyard.
Yeah. She told them that, and obviously they had all this information, and they actually said to her, "Fawzia, you're medium risk." And they actually said to her, "Look, we can't do anything about the £12,000 that he's stolen because he's going to turn round and say you gifted it to him." And she obviously showed them the transactions, online transactions that he'd done. So Fawzia thought, well, if there's nothing that they can do, I'm going to have to go. Because her plan was not to go back that day. That was it, to leave him, although she was just on a visit. But then she's like, well, it's my money. I've worked very, very hard for that money. She was a lawyer, very, very disciplined. She says, it's dishonest. I'm going to go back and try and persuade him and his parents to give me that money back.
Yeah. Yeah. and, you know, the thing here is that, you know, obviously Fawzia said that she didn't want to proceed with any investigation, didn't she?
And that was for two reasons. Firstly, she was scared of the repercussions.
Absolutely.
And secondly, she was like, any chance that I've got of getting that money back, he's not going to give it back to me.
Yeah, yeah.
But so you know, Fawzia
was reason with him. That's what she was hoping to do.
Yeah. But these were two police officers who'd actually said, we can do one of three things. We can take the statement and do nothing, put it on record, or we can go around and arrest him, talk to him and arrest him, or we can go over your head if we feel that we have to.
And that is the key point here. You know, they've given her three options.
Yeah.
They should never have given her any option. They've been made aware of a crime. They've been made aware of. They're aware that there is a woman that is well. Although they categorized her wrong. She was high risk at that point.
Yeah.
Well,
can I just say that? What happened after the murder, we found out after the first police visit, when they'd actually said to Fawzia on that visit, you're medium risk, that Fawzia had been reassessed again and regraded at high risk. And that information was never communicated to us.
No, she was high risk. She was high risk.
Yeah. But what I'm saying is that information was never communicated to us. And if you have now deemed somebody at high risk, surely you should be now taking steps to ensure the safety of that person.
Yeah. Just to clarify to the listeners, the police's job is to enforce law and order and to keep the public safe. That they are, their responsibility is to make decisions that are in the say best the best interest of the public, and the victim is deemed comes under that umbrella as the public. If they know something, somebody is at risk, it's their responsibility, regardless of what the victim says, their responsibility to take the right steps, the appropriate steps to secure that person's safety.
Absolutely. And the thing is, we've called in these two trained police officers and we are relying on their expertise and skills to give the correct advice. You know, me and Fozzie were not trained in this field. They are, and we're relying upon them.
And that's the thing. The issue, there's so many issues. There's so many issues within the system. They are, you know, and you know, in some ways, I do feel for them. They are running on empty. They are, but that's no excuse for failures. They need more officers. They need more better skilled professionals.
Yeah.
Response should not be dealing with domestic abuse cases because they can be, they haven't got the time to deal with them, to investigate. They haven't. They need dedicated teams that are effectively and thoroughly trained in domestic abuse. And it's not just enough to understand the nuts and bolts of coercive control, stalking and the law and all the abuse-related crimes. They also have to understand the psychology of the perpetrator and the psychology of the victim as well. Without that knowledge, they cannot do an effective job. Even if you are under a specialist team, and some obviously, some forces do and divisions do have them. But like I say, they are running on empty. So there are many, many, I know there are, there's divisions within GMP that, and GMP is a metropolitan force, that do not have a dedicated domestic abuse team, which is astonishing for the size of the force that they are. But that's because they're running on empty. They are running on minimum workforce. They just don't have the manpower to accommodate it. And, you know, it's just not acceptable. It's not acceptable. There are lives been lost because shortcuts are being taken because of their own personal circumstances.
Yeah.
And that's the reality. So we're going to end this episode here, and because it's quite a detailed one, and I want to do Fozzie justice, and I also want others to be able to benefit and learn from Fozzie's experiences. So we're going to follow on with this conversation with Yasmin on the next episode. So please do tune in to next week's episode, and we shall catch up with you all then.
Thank you for listening. To learn more about Kate's work, head to her bio on UK Health Radio. Until next time, stay strong, stay informed, and always remember, you're not alone.